Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, ghostly stories on our monthly book show. With us, reference librarian Jill Erickson. Hi, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Jan Ifredi. She's the past chair of Falmouth Reads Together. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Mindy.
It's just the season, right? How could we not do ghostly stories?
Well, and I know this really better than anyone because my birthday is October 30th.
No way. Okay.
And everyone always thought it was Halloween. So I know for sure it was it's the 31st, not the 30th.
Not the 30th.
But there's lots. a lot of books.
And yeah, who doesn't enjoy a good ghost story? Although this is like all kinds of scary stories. We're not just ghost stories we're talking about, right?
That's right. I certainly have more than ghosts. Yeah. And you, Jane,
I do too. A lot of things scare me. So I've got a wide variety.
There are things scarier than ghosts, right? All right. So what's your first book, Jill?
Well, this is one of those not a ghost, but really scary stories. A friend of mine suggested this when I said I was going to be doing the show. Shirley Jackson, as many of you probably know already, definitely her most known story is called The Lottery, which if you haven't read The Lottery, by all means do. It's very, very scary. But I've got a different one for you this morning. And this story is called The Summer People, mm-mm, which seemed very, very good timing. Here's just the very beginning of it. And you think it's going to be this sweet little story, and boy, it has a real punch to it at the end. The Allison's Country Cottage, 7 miles from the nearest town, was set prettily on a hill. From three sides, it looked down on soft trees and grass that seldom, even at midsummer, lay still and dry. On the fourth side was the lake, which touched against the wooden pier the Allisons had to keep repairing, and which looked equally well from the Allison's front porch, their side porch, or any spot on the wooden staircase leading from the porch down to the water. Although the Allisons loved their summer cottage, looked forward to arriving in the early summer, and hated to leave in the fall, they had not troubled themselves to put in any improvements regarding the cottage itself and the lake as improvement enough for the life left to them. The cottage had no heat, no running water except the precarious supply from the backyard pump, and no electricity. For 17 years, they're going to this cottage, and this particular year, they decide they want to stay through the fall. They don't want to just be summer people. They want to stay a little longer, and they're not working, so they can do this, and their children write them letters every so often, but not often enough. Well, I don't want to give away too much of the story, but once they decide that they're going to stay for a few more months, suddenly nobody in the town knows how to do anything that they need in order to stay alive. And not only does nobody in the town know nobody is going to help them because tourists are supposed to leave at a certain point. And if you don't leave, believe me, read this story because people, very bad things happen to summer tourists who do not leave when they're supposed to.
Bad things happen to people who don't leave when they're supposed to.
That's right. And that could be true of everything, not just summer people. But the summer people story is really, really good. And this volume that I'm holding is one of the Library of America titles that they've done. And in the back is actually also a biography of her most famous story, which is The Lottery. And she starts it saying, "On the morning of June 28, 1948, I walked down to the post office in our little Vermont town to pick up the mail. I was quite casual about it, as I recall. I opened the box, took out a couple of bills and a letter or two, talked to the postmaster for a few minutes, and left, never supposing that it was the last time for months that I was to pick up the mail without an active feeling of panic. Mm-hmm. By the next week, I'd had to change my mailbox to the largest one in the post office, and casual conversation with the postmaster was out of the question because he wasn't speaking to me. June 28, 1948 was the day the New Yorker came out with a story of mine in it. It was not my first published story, nor my last, but I've been assured over and over that if it had been the only story I ever wrote or published, there would be people who would not forget my name." Mm. And that, of course, is the story, The Lottery. And if you have never read it, it too, you have great chills in reading that.
We want to read these books in the daytime.
I would highly recommend reading them in the daylight.
And if,
you know, yes, and maybe in a library or something where there are a lot of people around.
Save me. Right. Jane, what's your first book?
Well, my first book is the first book I recall, the first adult book that I recall reading as a child. And that was Michael Crichton's The Andromeda Strain.
Oh, right.
Which scared the bejesus out of me as a young person, because, and I think Michael Crichton's great gift to the world is the level of detail that he employs in all of his books. And I think most people remember him most for Jurassic Park, mm-hmm. but The Andromeda Strain was the first novel that he wrote under his own name. It was published in 1969. And the basic premise of the book is that, an alien microbe attaches itself to a satellite that falls to Earth, and then everything is poisoned by this microbe. And a group of scientists are trying to not only solve the problem, but save the world. And he's written it in the form of a government report. So it feels incredibly real. And I recall, I'd have to like check in with my parents every once in a while. Like, are we sure this didn't happen? Is this really happening? And in preparation for the show, I went back and I read some other early reviews of the book. And all of these adult reviewers were saying the same thing. It's like I would wake up in the middle of the night and think this was really happening. And it's just one of those thrillers that sort of, you know, it has this sort of, you know, cosmic connection to it. That is really, and again, it's a sticky book. I mean, I just love books that I'm thinking about, you know, 40, 50, 60 years later that still thinking about. So that was one of my my first early favorites, and it got me hooked on sci-fi for many, many years after that.
The Andromeda Strain. It makes me think of, did either of you bring War of the Worlds?
Oh, a good one.
I was just thinking that. I mean, there were people who thought that was real, that radio broadcast.
Right. Yeah. And they actually, there was a whole book about the making of that radio and what happened once they did, and all the people that thought it was for real.
For real, yeah.
Yeah, I remember my mother talking about believing that it was real.
Really?
Yes. Wow. She and her parents were listening to, she was the oldest child, and they were all listening to it, and they all believed that it was real. I mean, for a split second.
Then you're going, wait a minute.
Right.
But yeah.
It's a little too calm. It's delivery on the radio for it to be real.
Exactly. And we should mention, if you have suggestions this morning on scary books for us, 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. What's next, Jill?
Well, this is a book that I first saw as a movie, as many of you may have first seen as a movie, and I didn't even know it was based on a book for a very long time. The book is by Jack Finney, and Jack Finney, as some of you regular listeners may know, I love his book Time and Again, which is a very different book from this one, but this is really interesting. And it is called The Body Snatchers.
Oh, right.
Which was a film before. And I knew the film, but I had never read the book. But the book is better in some ways than the film, because you can, of course, when you're creating it all in your head, right, it doesn't necessarily look the way the film looks. But this is also what I discovered in looking for a copy of this book. This is part of what's called the Stephen King Horror Library, which I did not know existed. This edition came out, I think, in the 80s at some point. But he did the introduction to this particular volume. And he has a lot of interesting things to say about the book itself, which was originally not a movie. It was originally a Dell paperback original in 1955. Mm. And that's when a lot of really scary stuff got put into paperbacks, like sort of stuff that wasn't as good as could have been in a real publisher rather than a paperback publisher. But his book did very well for itself, as it turns out. And here's a little bit about from Stephen King's intro to the book. He says, I think Finney's contention that The Body Snatchers is just a story is both right and wrong. My own belief about fiction, long and deeply held, is that story must be paramount over all other considerations in fiction, that story defines fiction, and that all other considerations, theme, mood, tone, symbol, style, even characterization, are expendable. There are critics who take the strongest possible exception to this view of fiction, and I really believe that they are the critics who would feel vastly more comfortable if Moby Dick were a doctoral thesis on cetology rather than an account of what happened on the Pequod's final voyage. And he sees that there's this really... He writes a very good intro about everything that happens in the course of this book. But, of course, one of my favorite parts of this book is when a librarian gets involved with the... And for those of you that don't know... anything about The Body Snatchers, it is taking place in a small town, and in this small town there are creatures that come in and start taking over everybody's body, and everybody knows somebody's not quite right, but they can't, because they try to imitate the person. They essentially take over the whole body of the person and try to be the person, but everyone, not everyone, but many people realize something's not quite right.
And it's always in a small town. Always in a small town.
In a small town. And this is, and the librarian does get involved. So here's, it's Miss Weygand was at the desk as we walked in, and I smiled with real pleasure, as always. She'd been librarian since I was a grade school kid, coming in for Tom Swift and Zane Grey books, and she was the opposite of the conventional notion of what a librarian usually is. She was a gray-haired, intelligent-eyed, brisk little woman, and you could talk in the main reading room of her library if you weren't too loud about it, and there were comfortable cushioned chairs beside low magazine-strewn tables. It was a nice place to spend a pleasant hour afternoon, a place where people met friends to talk quietly. She was wonderful with children, had an enormous natural and interested patience, and as a kid, I always remembered you felt welcome there and not an intruder. And he goes on to talk about what a wonderful woman she was until they figure out that she has already become one of these pod people. And then things do not quite go so well. And he writes later on, for a moment, she still stood glancing helplessly from me to Becky in utter bewilderment. Then suddenly she dropped the pretense. Gray-haired Miss Weygand, who 20 years ago had loaned me the first copy of Huckleberry Finn I ever read, looked at me, her face going wooden and blank with an utterly cold and pitiless alienness. There was nothing there now in that gaze, nothing in common with me. A fish in the sea had more kinship with me than this staring thing before me. Then she spoke. I know you, I'd said, and now she replied, and her voice was infinitely remote and uncaring. Do you? She said, then turned on her heel and walked away. Anyway, it's a really creepy story, but very you can speed through it. I wouldn't recommend reading it just before going to sleep. Maybe first thing
Nightmares.
In the morning. It's the novel that started the movie. It's called The Body Snatchers by Jack Finney.
And we have a suggestion. Henry James, 1898, The Turn of the Screw, a gothic classic.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. If you have thoughts on scary books you'd like to suggest for us this morning, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show. We're talking about ghostly stories, scary stuff. Reference librarian Jill Erickson is with us, and as is Jane Afredi. She's the past chair of Falmouth Reads Together. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a suggestion for our scary books this morning, 866-999-4626. 4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. What's next, Jane?
Well, I have to piggyback on Jill's Stephen King exploration, and I'd like to do that with actually three of his novels that, that are sort of, they're a little bit related, and they're certainly personal to me. The first two, and these are books that I read probably in junior high or high school, were Carrie, which was one of his first novels. Yeah. And The Shining.
And both of which were made into hugely successful films.
Right. Yes,
which doesn't always happen. Yeah.
And one of my memories from reading The Shining from high school, I had the same English teacher, Mr. Sanchez, for high school for all 4 years. And he was a Stephen King freak as well. He introduced us to all kinds of great literature, but his guilty pleasure was Stephen King. And we were reading The Shining at the same time and at relatively the same pace. And he'd keep telling me, they're going to make a movie about this, but I don't know how they're going to do, you know, X, Y, Z. Or, you know, the movie of The Shining is significantly different from the novel, The Shining. And so many more horrific things happen in the novel than they do in the movie.
Which is hard to believe once you've seen the movie, yes.
Right, right. But what I love about those two, and I'll get to the third one in a second, is that they're character-driven. You start to, you know, in odd ways, kind of fall in love with the main characters. You can relate to Carrie, who has a very difficult home life that translates in an even worse school life. And we all know what horrible things happen in that movie. The Shining, the same way. Poor Jack Torrance. I mean, the tortured writer trying to find a place where he can relax and write his great American novel. And then just everything goes to pot. Things that he couldn't even happen, couldn't even imagine happening. I was reminded of an SNL skit that's fairly recent with Maya Rudolph, and she takes on sort of the Jack Torrance character, and she has haunted the SNL set for its entire, 49 year run. And it's just a brilliant take on this classic. And the other thing that really I love about these two is they've inspired the cottage industry of takeoffs on this. There was a Carrie musical. Shining is, it's sort of a pop reference touchstone. Mm-hmm. Everybody sort of knows it and can go there. Everything from Red Rum to, the twins in the hallway and, all these other things. As soon as Stephen King's most recent book, it was published just about a month ago, Holly, came out, I have been infatuated with this text. Holly, the lead character, is Holly Gibney, and she's appeared in a couple of recent King books. She's a private investigator. She runs Finders Keepers firm. She takes on clients, and she's trying to find people. Right, she's doing these private investigations. Small college town in Maine is where everything is set. Things that are happening there are not quite on the up and up. Young people are disappearing. Every 3 years, a young person just suddenly disappears.
Never
a good sign. And so Holly is hired to find one of those missing people. But as she learns more, she ends up trying to find a lot of these missing people, which Stephen King is right up in the first chapter of the book. They're not coming back. So I can say that without spoiling anything. But what Stephen King does in this book, which is beautifully done, this is a very contemporary book. The horrors in this book are not just these disappearances. It's coronavirus. It's divisive politics. They're tearing people apart, tearing families apart. I'd love to read just sort of one short clip, excerpt from this. Early in the book, Holly stands at the living room window of her tidy little apartment, looking down on the street and remembering the last meal with her mother. I should say as an aside, her mother is an anti-vaxxer and she's just died of coronavirus. An authentic Christmas dinner, just like the old days, Charlotte, her mother, had said, cheery and excited on top, but with that constant anxiety pulsing away underneath. The authentic Christmas dinner had been consisted of dry turkey, lumpy mashed potatoes, and flabby spears of asparagus. Oh, and a thimble of that glass of Mogan David wine to toast with. How terrible that meal had been, and how terrible it had been that it had been their last. Did Holly say, "I love you, Mom," before she drove away the next morning? She thinks so, but she can't remember for sure. All she can remember is for sure is the sign of relief she felt as she turned the first corner and her mother's house was no longer in the rearview mirror. It's tough interpersonal politics or, you know, relationships. And he just does a very good job. And again, I can't stop thinking about Holly. Ooh. She's such an engaging character.
And boy, does he have an imagination. How does he come book after book after book, right? Oh, my goodness.
Amazing.
Yeah, so
amazing.
Stephen King, Holly. All right, Jill, what's next?
Well, I asked one of my neighbors was there any scary book that she especially liked? And she said, oh, no, she can't read scary stuff. Absolutely not. And however, she would ask her fifth grader, who loves to read everything that he can get his hands on that's scary. I was like, okay, well, what book would he recommend? And he recommended a John Bellairs mystery, book title is The House with the Clock in Its Walls. Now, this apparently there was a major motion picture built on this, which was terrible, apparently, from all the reviews I said. But the book itself is really sweet, and very scary. And how they could ruin this book as a movie, I don't know, but apparently they did. And this is what the New York Times wrote about this. It's the aura of this story. It's blend of the everyday and the supernatural that makes it glow among a plethora of lackluster occult books this spring. The ingredients are familiar: a Chaz Adams house with cozy fireplaces, dark secret corridors, darker shadows. Somewhere in the house, there is an enchanted clock that must be found before it relentlessly ticks off the time till doomsday. Then there is a newly orphaned boy. And I have to say, the boy gets orphaned like in the first two pages, and we essentially never hear about his parents again. I don't know. But he comes to live with his weird beard uncle, who turns out to be a wizard practicing white magic. Next door is a witch who prefers to be called a maga or enchantrix. What the author has done that's so special is to touch both the intellect and the feelings. He has dusted off the paraphernalia of ancient magic and made us newly aware of the difference between good and evil. His dialogue goes snap, crackle, and pop. He sets chilling scenes with suspense that tightens like a screw. If anyone's possessed of second sight, he will see that the house with a clock in its walls will cast its spell for a long time. Now, that's a pretty great review, and the book is very fun. And he went on to write a lot of more of these mysteries that were basically fifth grader and up, I would suppose. And it is a very creepy story. But one of the things I really like about it is they're trying to find where this clock is. And I have a real affection for actual clocks. And so I was like, I hope they're going to find the clock. They're going to find the clock. And happily they did. But what I also can tell you about this book, which I had no idea when I picked it up, is that Edward Gorey did the illustrations for this book. And of course, that I was like, for any of you that have listened to this show for a while, I knew Edward and was in some of his plays, I knew he did book jackets. I did not know he had done this book jackets, but there is a recent book called Edward Gorey, His Book Cover Art and Design, which is quite beautiful. And it does show, because one of the things I really hated about this paperback I was reading, I didn't like the cover at all. When I saw that Edward had done the illustrations, I thought he must have done the book jacket too, because he did a lot of book jackets. And sure enough, I think those of you in the studio will agree with me that his cover is substantially better than the and they probably are now. Yeah, they were trying,
because that doesn't the cover that's on the book doesn't look anything like what he would do.
Absolutely, and it's too bad. But the drawings, of course, the drawings are the same. They just destroyed the cover, which seems unfortunate. But this book, Edward Gorey's book cover art and design, actually is really fascinating. And he did a lot of covers, and he was really good at it. And one of the reasons they say in this book he was so good at doing book jackets is, unlike many book jacket illustrators, they don't actually read the book. They're given a summary. Edward
read
loved
the book.
To read.
Yeah.
And he had, I mean, thousands of books in his library when he died, which you can all see now online. You know, they've been all cataloged. But this book is really quite beautiful.
The War of the Worlds, right? Look at that.
Yes, yeah. There's The War of the Worlds right there as well. Another great creepy story. So for both creepy stories and not so creepy stories, Edward Gorey, his book cover art and design, with an essay by Stephen Heller, which talks a lot about how he came to be. It takes, you know, I think it starts from when he's born, essentially the intro, but where he was in Harvard and how he ended up not leaving Cambridge, because he loved being in Cambridge, but all the book publishers wanted him were in New York City. So
okay, Jane.
My next book is The Parable of the Sower by the late and very great Octavia Butler. This book was written in 1993, and she could not have described 2024, which is where the book is set, any more, well, I won't say accurately, because we haven't quite hit things. Things aren't that bad yet. She's sort of described maybe the tenor of our divisive times, probably better than most, and she did it, decades ago. So The Parable of the Sower is part of a trilogy that she wrote in the 1990s. I think it would be best categorized not as science fiction, but as speculative fiction. So she's describing in The Parable of the Sower, 2024, California, post-apocalyptic, people have sort of devolved into neighborhood groups. You're either trying to protect what you've got on your cul-de-sac, which is sort of where she is. She's got there's a family compound there. And the main character is a teenager who's living with her family and this extended family of other homeowners on the block and trying to survive while people are constantly coming at them, trying to take whatever, fragile resources they have as a coping mechanism. For just these horrific living conditions, she starts to kind of envision this this religion. She read something about it, and she envisions herself being a part of it. And when things become just untenable where she's living in Southern California, she starts to walk north to where she believes there is this compound of like-minded people. I think it's called Earth Seed. I think maybe because it's 2024 and because there are probably parts of the world where we can see this sort of, living conditions. It feels very real, and it feels like it's not that far off, which is frightening, very frightening for me and other people I've known who've read it. And she makes this trek, and it's just the most horrific tale of survival against all sorts of predators coming after her and trying to get to this imagined place in the future that is better. And I won't say what happens at the very end. But it's a stunning book, and I came to Octavia Butler quite late in life. I think I've read this within the last year. Mm-hmm. And I'm very excited to get back into the rest of her canon.
Great. And the name of the book again is?
The Parable of the Sower.
Right. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show. We're talking about scary stories this morning with Jill Erickson, reference librarian, and Jane Ifrady. She's the past chair of Falmouth Reads Together. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to suggest a book for our list this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill?
Well, we can't go through this whole show without my mentioning Edgar Allan Poe. And it is so creepy. And may I just say once again, a shout out to my sixth grade teacher who read us things after lunch. And any of you who've listened regularly, Miss Caggiano's come up a lot lately. It's just, she was a great reader of scary things, that's for sure, as well as non-scary things. But she read to us his short story, The Telltale Heart. And if you haven't read The Telltale Heart, like, go do it right now. and it will scare you. And it begins, "True, nervous, very, very dreadfully nervous I had been and am, but why will you say that I am mad?" I was like, how can you not keep reading? And it is a truly terrifying story. And there are many of them. He also, of course, did The Raven, the poem The Raven. Mm-hmm. "Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. 'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door. Only this and nothing more." And of course, it goes on. It's still really creepy. And what I did not know, what I learned in this volume, this is another Library of America volume by that features Poe, and they always put in a chronology, and I did not know that he had actually been born in Boston. So he's a, because I always I think he's in Philadelphia, but I think he died in Philadelphia or something. He wasn't born there. And he was the second of three children in Boston. And the other thing you learn here within this chronology, his parents, David and Elizabeth Arnold Poe, are actors in a theatrical company. Elizabeth Poe, of English descent, is a well-known leading lady whose mother, Elizabeth Smith Arnold, was also prominent in the early American theater. David Poe, son of an Irish-born Revolutionary War patriot, soon after abandons the family. Mother dies December 8th in Richmond, Virginia. The children, William Henry, Edgar, and Rosalie, become wards of different foster parents.
Wow.
So he ends up with foster parents that he is taken to the home of Francis and John Allen, a prosperous Richmond tobacco merchant born in Scotland. Although not legally adopted by the childless couple, he is renamed Edgar Allen and reared as their son. So you sort of begin to understand why
where he gets
all this scary stuff that he must have thought of when his parents were both gone and he was taken to different parents. Anyway, this collection of poetry and tales is quite delightful, and it will certainly be good for Halloween reading.
Laura writes that she missed the name of the first book discussed. She said just prior to Shirley Jackson. Wasn't Shirley Jackson your first book?
Yes, Shirley Jackson, Novels and Stories.
Okay, so that's the first book. And we will have a list of all the books we talk about today up on our website a little bit later on today. Jane, what's next?
Well, let's go nonfiction,
which can be even scarier.
A book that was published in 2016 by Stacy Schiff is called "The Witches: Suspicion, Betrayal, and Hysteria in 1692 Salem." there have been so many books written about the Salem witch trials over the years, and they tend to lean toward a single explanation for the horror that happened in Salem and Danvers at that time. But what Stacy Schiff does is she examines all of those, all of the sort of the pressures that were on the Salem community during that time frame, and sort of layers them such that I think we get a fuller understanding of what kind of craziness actually happened there. She looks at things like the never-ending fear of Native American attacks from without the community, the prevailing social and economic tensions. And interestingly, the influx of refugees from the King William's War, which was happening in New York and southern Canada at that time. These are a lot of pressures coming in and making people very anxious about their the access to the resources that they have been accustomed to. Then you layer upon that just sort of interpersonal rivalries and people wanting that farm over there rather mm-hmm. than the one that they're on. And you know, it's a strange brew that ends up becoming the Salem Witch Trials. It's a really engaging read. It's not academic in the kind of the strongest sense. It reads like a novel. It's really engaging, and the two of you probably know I have a personal connection mm-hmm. to this. My mother's family is a descendant from the Putnams of Salem and Danvers of that time, and one of the Putnam children was among the accusers of that time. She fortunately, you know, it mitigated some of my lingering shame about that connection. She later recanted her testimony several years later. Yeah, exactly. So I've read just a number. I think I wrote one of my first book reports as a child about the Salem Witch Trials, and have read a lot of the texts. And I think this one is among the very best. And again, it's The Witches: Suspicion, Betrayal, and Hysteria in 1692 Salem by Stacy Schiff.
Excellent. All right, Jill.
Okay. Well, we have to have at least one poem here, and this is, believe it, I didn't think I would be able to find such a book, but this is called Poems, Bewitched and Haunted. It's one of the Everyman's Library Poetry series, and it has scary-looking pumpkins on the cover. And one of the poems that I've discovered, which I thought was really sort of lovely, was by Emily Dickinson. Huh. And she wrote a poem called The Only Ghost I Ever Saw. The only ghost I ever saw was dressed in mechlin, so he wore no sandal on his foot and stepped like flakes of snow. His gait was soundless like the bird, but rapid like the roe. His fashions quaint, mosaic, or haply mistletoe. His conversation seldom, his laughter like the breeze that dies away in dimples among the pensive trees. Our interview was transient, of me himself was shy, and God forbid I look behind since that appalling day. And that was called The Only Ghost I Ever Saw, which apparently was very impressed. She was impressed by. But I also learned that mechlin, which was a word I was not familiar with, it turns out was a delicate bobbin lace used for dresses, and first known use was in 1689. I'm like, well, the things one can learn from one small poem. And there's a whole bunch of poems in here, most of which are far too long to share with you, but it's an interesting collection. And if you are of a poetry mind, this might be just the book for you for Halloween. Poems, Bewitched and Haunted.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to share a thought on a scary book to put on our list this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jane, what's next?
Well, I think we'd be remiss if we did not mention The Exorcist.
Oh, boy.
1971.
Another film.
The scariest movie I ever saw.
Oh, absolutely. So
I don't
never
like
seen
scary
the movie.
Movies anymore. Oh, don't.
No, I will not.
No.
I will not. Anyways, The Exorcist by William Peter Blatty. I think we all know the plot. I won't go into any
Even
of that.
Even just the
details.
Trailer will scare you half to death.
My main connection that I'll relate today is mainly just the personal story of how I came to read this book. And my mother...
You read the whole book?
I read the book. And I'll say my mother lives in California and it's too early for her to be listening in live so I can tell this story.
Without having her
call. Without, right. Phone call later.
Without her getting on the phone.
Exactly. So a friend, sixth grade, a friend and a friend tells me that her parents have a copy of The Exorcist on the bookshelf at home, but she won't read it alone. Mm. Will I come over after school and read along with her? It's just like, yes, I will. Forbidden fruit, right? So over, you know, over several weeks under the guise of going to study together, we would sit in their living room till her mother came home from work, and we'd read as much of it as we could together. Scarred for life doesn't even.
I know. I was doesn't like, even I can't believe you guys kept going.
We kept going. Because we knew we weren't supposed to. So we did it.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think for years after that, I think I slept with the covers like half over my head. And sometimes I still kind of find myself with the covers kind of creeping. And it's almost a, you know, an autonomic kind of reaction to just going to bed and thinking about that. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Terrifying.
Terrifying is right.
But I certainly, from what I've heard about the movie, reading the book is a better experience than seeing the movie.
I didn't read the book, but I did see the movie a long, long, long time. I was in high school, so it was
oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Jill.
Okay. Here's a very big book, and actually I didn't even, the volume before this was even bigger. This is the new annotated H.P. Lovecraft, Beyond Arkham, with an introduction by Victor Laval. I have to say, it's so interesting. I went to get some Lovecraft book off the library shelves for this show, and there's like a whole shelf of Lovecraft-related things there. And when I was first working there, that was at the library, one of the most stolen books was the Lovecraft books. We could not keep them on the shelf. And this is like, I'm talking pre-internet, right? Mm-hmm. So people had to steal them because they wanted to read them over and over and over again. I find them terribly scary and upsetting, but you may feel differently. But what I did find in this book, and well, first of all, I found how many copies of Lovecraft we now have at the Falmouth Public Library. It's very impressive, including a book about him that he wrote. But one of the books that is mentioned in here, it's all set in Providence, and they've created the photos. They have photos in the book of all the sections that are specifically, because he was living in Providence at one point.
He's buried there, Dan says.
He's buried there. I wouldn't want to go to that grave. But it's really fascinating to see how much is still standing in Providence that is connected to his stories. And this one is called The Shunned House, and it's just really fun to look to see what is still there, what isn't still there. And the stories themselves, you either love him, I think, or you can't sleep again ever again after reading one of his books. And there was this great write-up about him in the New York Times. And the fellow that writes it says, I came to Lovecraft in my late teens when a friend gave me a copy of At the Mountains of Madness, the story of a geologist whose explorations of Antarctica uncovered the remnants of ancient alien life forms. I didn't feel an emotional connection to Lovecraft the way Laval did as a kid, who's the editor of these, but the apprentice writer in me was thrilled by his inventiveness and a certain veracity of the imagination that shaped everything. History, myth, superstition, reality, fiction, science, everything to suit his vision. Mm. So really scary book, but by all means, pick up some Lovecraft for Halloween.
Dan has that book. I'm assuming, is it on your nightstand, a little nightly reading with a little Lovecraft?
Oh.
All right, Jane, what's next?
Well, one, I sort of hesitate to bring this as a horror or a scary story, because it's definitely not in that genre. This is very much very literary fiction, and it's companion piece by Allie Smith, which is probably one of the books that I've read over the last couple of years that, again, can't stop thinking about. It's just a wonderfully written, Jill, you would love this book. Mindy, of course, you would too. I mean, it's all about language and literature, but it's a COVID book, and it's crafted in three pieces, and she links because she links COVID to sort of past plagues in a really interesting way. But what is frightening, and I haven't read a book in a long time that really made my heart beat faster because I was so horrified by what was going on. And it's the center of this centerpiece of this book, which you I won't say a lot about it because you have to read it to really kind of understand what's actually happening, to read the whole book to understand that middle section of it. But every fear that we had during the start, especially of COVID, about how we became infected and what the results were, and layered upon that is sort of new technology and the way that we can exploit other people online for our own benefit or to their detriment, all layered in the middle section of this book. And you just can't quite wrap your head around what is actually happening. It's happening so fast and so unrelentingly that you get to the end of it. I remember I got to the end of it and I thought, oh my God, What happened? Because it's just stopped so abruptly, right when you think everything's going to implode. It's just a beautifully written book. It's one of my favorite books of all time. And
wow, of all
Jill,
time. Wow.
Jill knows that I have this affection for the American Renaissance. And so reading contemporary literature is a stretch for me just to begin with.
But so many, I just read a really great novel that was written during COVID. I think the writers had so much more time on their hands, some of them, but others, of course, were dealing with children at home. Mm-hmm. But it's really interesting how much some really great stuff
came out of that time.
Literary stuff came out.
Absolutely.
Being home.
Name again is?
It's Companion Piece by Allie Smith, who is a Scottish writer.
Great. All right, Jill.
Well, this I came across just yesterday, and it's so exciting. I think everybody should look at it. I found out already so many women I didn't know about. This is called Monster, She Wrote, The Women Who Pioneered Horror and Speculative Fiction by Lisa Kroeger and Melanie R. Anderson. First of all, it's a beautiful little book, and it's got lots of great quotes in it. But what they're doing here, here's a little bit of the intro. The question is, why are women great at writing horror fiction? Maybe because horror is a transgressive genre. It pushes readers to uncomfortable places where we aren't used to treading, and it forces us to confront what we naturally want to avoid. And one of the things I found was so great about this, where it's so many women I'd never heard of that I'm like, oh, now I have to read her. Have you ever heard of Margaret Cavendish as a writer?
No.
These are the founding mothers. Margaret Cavendish, never heard of her. Anne Radcliffe, I've heard of. Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, yes. But Regina Marie Roche, is that name familiar? No. Mary Ann Radcliffe, Charlotte Dacre. I mean, all these names I've never heard before, which is really fascinating. But also you find Edith Wharton. I didn't know Edith Wharton wrote lots of really big ghost stories. Lots of people are in here. V.C. Andrews. I mean, it's all over the map. It's women who wrote The Pulps, Paperback Horror, Haunting the Home, The Future of Horror and Speculative Fiction. It has a whole section on what else you could read once you've read all the novels that these women have written. It's really
a new beautiful book.
This is, you know, it's fairly new because I don't think it's been checked out enough is what I would say, because this is 2019 is when this came out. It should be in tatters by now. Yeah. Monster, She Wrote, The Women Who Pioneered Horror and Speculative Fiction. It is really, really an incredible cache of titles, authors you might not know, authors you would know if you want to read about more monsters written by women.
So we've talked about monsters, ghosts, witches, aliens, and Carolyn in Marston's Mills is reading my mind because she writes, the granddaddy of them all, Bram Stoker Dracula. I never drink wine. You will close this book at the end of the story and you will never be the same again.
So true.
Carolyn.
It's true.
Thank you. I was going to say, where are the vampire stories, right? Where are the vampires? And of course, the Dracula movie is great too. All right, Jane Ifrady, a past chair of Falmouth Reads Together, reference librarian Jill Erickson. Thank you both. Such fun books you picked for us this morning to scare us half to death.
Thank you.
And we'll have a list of all the books we talked about this morning on our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle.